And greetings to everyone tuning in from around the world, and welcome to the People's Struggle Podcast. You're listening to our special series, Media Militants, unveiling imperialism and militarism in mass media. My name is Cody Urban. I'm a member of the International Coordinating Committee of the International League of People's Struggle, or ILPS, talking to you from Portland, Oregon, in the United States.
Hi, Cody. Greetings from Manila, Philippines. I am Mensch from the International League of People's Struggle, also your host for the People's Struggle podcast, brought to you by the ILPS.
The ILPS is an international united front organization of over 400 mass organizations in 45 countries and territories around the world. We bring together our organizations on shared analysis and action through conferences, publications, campaigns, and convergences that uplift our shared fights against the global imperialist system.
As we strive to foster greater solidarity and collective awareness across borders, we are thrilled to introduce this exciting new podcast series. Join us as we delve deep into the topic of imperialism, exploring its manifestations in our everyday lives. And remember that as you are listening in and you think of ideas of what you'd like to hear in future programs, please email us at peoplespodcast@ilps.info, or you may comment down below the podcast and let us know your ideas.
All right, Mensch, we're on our third episode of this podcast. As a reminder to our listeners, our first two episodes were two parts of a series looking at science fiction and fantasy movies. But today we're going to be looking at the ongoing crackdown on press freedom in India, home to thousands of journalists and press freedom advocates.
That's right, Cody. And just last October 3, the homes of over 100 journalists, contractors, and former employees associated with the progressive news outlets such as NewsClick and People's Dispatch, as well as Tricontinental Research Services, were raided by Indian authorities in the early morning in the capital, New Delhi. Several raids were also carried out in the cities of Noida, Ghaziabad, Gurgaon, and Mumbai. And according to local reports, there was around 50 individuals. They were also taken into the police station for additional questioning.
So it's time to introduce our first ever guest for this podcast. She is from the South Asia Research and Resource Center, or SERAS, Montreal. She is the founding member of the South Asian Women's Community Center based in Montreal, Quebec, Canada. We have today with us Dolores Chu. Hi, Dolores. How are you?
I'm very well, Cody, Mensch, despite these intense times that we're living in. But it sort of brings us all together. And in a way, that's fantastic because it reminds us that we're not alone. And this is a joint struggle.
It's so great to have you with us today, Dolores, as also our first guest for our podcast. So since we've mentioned a while ago, this specific episode is dedicated and focused on the current situation in India. First off, we think it's really important to situate what India is and its strategic and geopolitical importance. And as a major player in both the Asian and global arenas, what are the key factors driving India's geopolitical importance?
Well, there's so much to say, but I think very simply, one can say that historically, India, sort of at the time of the two superpowers, was seen to be more closely identified with the Soviet Union and not the USA. But since the breakup of the Soviet Union and the fact that we're living to some extent in a unipolar world, Indian allegiances have gradually also, as the politics at the governing level has become more neoliberal, sort of slid to the right. The other aspect is that India borders China. And in the global political situation today, China is seen as a threat, is characterized as a threat, as Chinese economic influence has grown and trading influence has grown. And so India is being wooed by so-called Western powers to kind of be a bulwark against China. And this has also meant that a lot of the domestic policies of the Indian government, which traditionally might have invited at least a modicum of criticism from outside, there is silence.
Dolores, India is known for its vast global diaspora, with millions of Indian expatriates living around the world. And of course, this means that many Indian people get their updates on what's happening back home just from the news media. The media almost shapes reality for people living overseas and not very close to the conditions back home. So what are the social, economic, and political implications that this massive diaspora brings? How does it impact the ways that Indians engage politically with the situation back home?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question because, I mean, it's focusing on the Indian diaspora, which, as you've noted, is very, very large, with a lot of people of Indian origin living outside India. But the question, you know, talking about the media and updates, etc., I would also suggest that even people living within India are hugely dependent on the media and media control. And outside sort of also the mainstream media, social media. So social media is very, very influential in framing people's perceptions of the politics, of the governance, of the politicians. And unfortunately, it tends to sort of cater to the lowest common denominator of sensationalism, doxing, threatening, silencing, etc. So we're seeing this outside in the diaspora as well as within India.
Right now, I'm seeing like parallels with the present situation also in Palestine, which the world is really all looking at the developments. And it's a huge factor of how Western media has been portraying the Palestinians, those communities residing in Gaza for the longest time. And also what is the hand of U.S. imperialism to Israeli state, no, with the portrayal of the Palestinians, especially with the ongoing and intensifying war and genocide in Palestine and specifically in Gaza. Also, it also has its parallels with how the Israelis collaborate with Indians across the world and specifically with the Indian government, not just with militarily, but also through intelligence, cybersecurity, and high technology infrastructure, and even, of course, largely on resource management. So these portrayals of strategic partnerships or allies between Israel and India, Israel and US in the oppression of our national minorities and even the Palestinians and those of in India, such as the Kashmiris, it actually emulates how Israel manages its oppression upon these countries and communities. So, with this kind of synergy, it's really widely described. Also, it's not difficult to look at it as how there is a proximity between how Zionism is and how Hindu nationalism is fueled also foremost by these structural dynamics. So yeah, it's good that you have mentioned that, and maybe later on throughout our discussion, we can shed more light about this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's really important. I mean, we're talking about Palestine right now, and of course, the whole world is watching, and people around the world are taking to the streets because of the bombing of Gaza and the humanitarian crisis. But it's also giving those of us who've been working in the area of Palestinian solidarity for decades a chance to kind of remind people that this basic situation of occupation, and if you understand it from that perspective, and everything else makes sense. But sort of also connecting to what you were saying earlier about the media in India and also the diaspora and Palestine, it's really so tangible. Just this evening in Montreal, we have organized conversation with an author of a book, Azad Issa, and the book is about the ties between Israel and India and the military alliances, and how Israel boasts that its military hardware that's exported is battle tested. And what does battle tested mean? That means you've used it locally on Palestinians. Also, just the other day, one of our colleagues on the West Coast, Harsha Walia, was giving a solidarity speech in Vancouver at a Palestinian demo. And it went on Twitter, and a woman in the U.S., in part of the Indian diaspora, who's very, very connected with a Hindutva camp in India and overseas, you know, said, oh, look at her, you know, like there are those hand gliders, you know, Hamas terrorists, and there she is. And then a sort of mainstream media pundit in Canada, a white man, Andrew Coyne, up and said, oh, yes, there's that woman, you know, notorious Harsha Walia. It's ganging up, and this sort of, you know, kind of mass feeding that happens in the media when people who have consistently stood up, you know, Harsha Walia is also very well known for speaking out in defense of indigenous rights here and land. And in fact, that's what got her into a lot of hot water recently as well. So how all these sort of status quo establishment individuals, politicians, and their minions gang up and use media and social media to try to silence, to try to intimidate is very, very palpable, especially now, again, in the times where we're living in, where there's so much harassment of people who are involved in Palestinian solidarity work, you know, and on colleges and campuses, etc. But what is really heartening is that thousands and thousands of people, like Montreal has always had a strong Palestinian solidarity movement, but this has eclipsed everything in the past. I mean, people from different backgrounds, from different ethnicities are just so angry and just horrified at what is going on.
I want to hone in a bit on the ideological movement coming out from India that is pushing for this ganging up, as you're calling it, Dolores, using the news media as its platform. Mm-hmm. The Hindutva movement has gained a lot of prominence, not only in India, but also among the India diaspora around the world. And I want to let you get into the details, but I do have to mention, of course, because you're speaking from Canada, there was the very famous case not too long ago where a religious Sikh activist was actually murdered murdered who is an Indian and Canadian citizen. And it was a lot of evidence is coming out too that this was actually an inside job by the government from forces that were very loyal to Prime Minister Modi. And of course, a lot of these open calls, these calls for violence, these calls for incitement, hatred, really, are coming right out in the open from some of the most powerful news media with nothing to hold it back. What is the Hindutva movement? How and why is this ideology being exported globally? And what are the implications for the diaspora communities and the countries they reside?
Yeah, so the Hindutva movement is a movement that's actually been around for a long time, but it was sort of a marginal movement. It was a movement that earned a lot of criticism and disgust and hatred at a certain time. I mean, it's an individual linked to this movement had assassinated Mohandas Gandhi, and the organization he was involved with, one of the many Hindutva, was banned for a long time. But it sort of grown and spread to the point of respectability, and individuals who in the past did their dirty work in the shadows, whether it was in India or in the diaspora, are now just so proudly flaunting these Hindutva colors. And it's in a large degree due to the fact that the current government of India is the party that supports making India a Hindu nation. So it's become so, it's become the status quo now. And those of us who are critical are the ones who are being framed as the marginalized, as the sort of fringe element. So it's really gone mainstream. And that's happened as a result of a variety of factors, both within India and outside India. So outside India, for example, for a long time, people who arrived in places like Canada and Britain and United States from India, first generation immigrants, were sort of very grateful to be able to be here, et cetera, tended to vote for, mainstream liberal parties, et cetera. But as individuals in these communities have become more affluent, they seek to identify with established elites, white elites, economic elites, etc. And we see that, like, looking at the Prime Minister of Britain and some of the ministers, some of the most hateful individuals who are so racist against the, minority communities. So the kind of becoming part of the establishment has given them a certain kind of positioning. As the dominant political establishment in India, and when I say dominant, I mean the people who hold the reins of power, the people who are the home ministers and can call on the police and the army, etc., they are also from this Hindutva ideology group. So they kind of work together very, very much in tandem, supporting one another, mirroring what is happening, and getting more and more emboldened with the fact that there are no sanctions against them. In Canada, we have been writing to the government and warning them of the growth of this movement, that people in their own political parties are supporting it. And it wasn't until, as you mentioned, the assassination, the extrajudicial killing of Mr. Nidgar, that suddenly the Canadian government sat up. But much to our frustration and anger, they are still not looking at the larger picture that we are sort of pulling them in and trying to bring their noses to. So right now there is a petition in the House of Commons in Canada to recognize something called Hindu phobia, and they have mobilized and got close to 26,000 signatures for this. And if it gets recognition, then a lot of what I do and friends and colleagues and people like me who are also teaching, and we teach about caste, etc., can be hauled up for hate speech. And also coming back to the, not just the popularization, but the sort of impunity with which this ideology continues to sort of, kind of spread out and co-opt people who might otherwise be people of goodwill, is the political situation that we just talked about earlier. India as a geopolitical kind of bastion against China and so on. And so governments are loath to challenge any of the, not just the positioning, but the actions and also the inaction that is genocidal, targeting of minorities and so on.
And of course, this is related to years of violence and hatred being spewed by Modi. And I'm not just talking about Modi as the Prime Minister of India, but very famously, before he was Prime Minister, he was Chief Minister of the state of Gujarat, and he was bringing his own Hindutva nationalism, almost this fascist consolidation of power that he and his cronies were taking and using it as a way to incite racial hatred or caste hatred and religious hatred, famously leading to, one might call it a pogrom, calling for the mass murder of Muslims in the state, which many Hindu citizens took up. When there were criticisms of the government, we know that what do fascists do? They point to the problem somewhere else. They say, no, it is this other people. No, it is this other country. No, it is anything except for us. And that confuses the people, whips them into a frenzy. And ever since we saw Modi doing that in Gujarat state and he took to the prime minister, we've seen these attacks totally expand. I mean, it's what you're saying. Hindutva has been around for so long. In fact, we could even argue that it was, you know, implanted and inflamed during the British imperial period to divide and rule the people. It's this leftover aspect of imperialism that has been kept into the culture by the ruling elites, and the mass media is definitely one of the main ways to use that. And so I really think that the way that you describe how the news media is used to whip up these frenzies and how it's continuing that legacy of divide and conquer that the British brought in during their era of imperialism. It's almost like the rulers that are left there are just the exact ones that the British and foreign capital would have wanted. So thank you so much for going into that. But I'll pass it to Menchi next to ask another question.
To what extent has Indian media been instrumental in either inadvertently or deliberately promoting ideologies linked to Hindu violence and far-right policies? Like, can you provide concrete or specific examples?
Well, we know that the mainstream media in India is owned and controlled by one or two business houses, and they have all been, as we say, modified. You know, it's a play on modified and modified. And it's really individuals or small groups of really brave people who are putting out information on YouTube channels or alternative channels, etc. So it's very, what should be, really protected, freedom of the press, etc., has completely been undermined. And media people, either because, some of them might ideologically support Hindutva, or it's good for their economies and their business, or people are genuinely afraid. And sometimes it's not just your own self and your kind of any bodily harm you might get, against yourself, but also your family and your extended family. And so there could be violent attacks. Journalists have been assassinated and killed. And these are journalists who also write in the non-English media. So the English press is there, it's sort of, I would use the term elite, but, middle-class people. But there's also been historically very vibrant press in local languages. And some of the reporters from these local language presses have actually been assassinated, but more effective in reaching the people. Just recently, you mentioned when we started the podcast that just in the last few weeks, people associated with a news organization, again, an alternative news organization that courageously has put out exactly what's happening, NewsClick, have been harassed, detained, questioned, and two of them have been arrested under this very draconian law, the Unlawful Activities Prevention Act, UAPA. And if you are arrested under that, it's really unlikely that you can even get bail. And so it's a silencing tool that has been used and continues to be used. So it's extremely, extremely difficult. And the people who are continuing to write and publish and broadcast are real heroes and very courageous people.
Dolores, these attacks on journalists and press freedom advocates are very significant and, of course, a major attempt by those in power in the ruling government to silence them, to silence the truth. But I'm also wondering, what are the implications of this on ordinary Indian people? I mean, let's be honest, the vast majority of people who are impacted negatively and face the attacks by the government are poor workers and farmers and indigenous people.
Yes. And so again, like who anyway access the mainstream media to a certain extent, limited, of course, if it's English media, but perhaps even with print media that's in local languages, you know, there are still a lot of people in India who do not read or write. One of the sort of also very effective mechanisms, and that's not just restricted to India, but globally, is what we call the WhatsApp University, right? Things can be put out there, and whether they are fact-checked or not, whether they're invented, whether they're spurious, whether they're lies, they get a life of their own. And they have spread very, very quickly and virally, right? And they get people worked up, they get people mobilized, they get people involved in mob culture, lynch culture, etc. And it doesn't really matter whether it's true or not. As I was saying, it just takes on a life of its own and gets repeated again and again. So ordinary people, it's very hard now to kind of figure out what is the truth and what is an invention. And again, this is not unique to India. I mean, we've seen it with, you know, the forces that support Trump and have just blatantly believed the lies that have been put out there. So this is a global phenomena. And for those of us who are involved in, you know, community work and trying to support democracy and resistance, it makes our work even harder. Just with this whole concept of Hindu phobia, it's just such a clever strategy, because your average person or person of goodwill will say, oh yeah, Hindu phobia, that's bad. I mean, Hindu shouldn't be targeted or attacked. Okay, I'll sign this petition. I'll join on. Totally unaware of the context in which this construction has been formulated. Very much like the weaponizing of anti-Semitism. Today and tomorrow in Montreal, at McGill University, in the Faculty of Religious Studies, there is a conference happening on the phobias. And what are the phobias that are listed? Anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, Hindu phobia. The Faculty of Religious Studies at McGill has organized such an event. So it's reached these levels. And when you go and you look at who are the people who are speaking, you know, very obscure individuals who, when you look into their work, you know, support the Hindutva agenda, attack people who are critical of the Hindutva agenda, who's the speaker on anti-Semitism from a Canadian organization called the Canadian Institute for Jewish Affairs, which has kind of hijacked all Jewish community organizations under its umbrella. They have come to my college and attacked us personally for events we've had. They organize workshops on how to disrupt. There's a lot of a lot of this work going on, and we feel like embattled. We're fighting fires on so many fronts. Just this past week, every day letters are arriving in our inboxes, you know, sign this petition for Palestine, sign this petition in support of students who are being harassed because of Palestine, you know, sign this petition for this Hindutva group that is organizing an event here, sign this letter to the dean of McGill. So it's just increasing. And I hate to say this because I'm very dogged, but sometimes you feel that it's just the time you're living in is so it's so difficult that to keep your sanity, to keep your energy is a real challenge. And again, it's only in these moments of coming together as communities, whether it's online, whether it's through podcasts and sharing and informing one another, that we can keep up the resistance and hopefully outlive these horrible movements and individuals that are totally self-centered, totally selfish. They have no care for humanity. You were talking about Gujarat. You know, we call what happened in Gujarat in 2002 a genocide. And we said Modi is using Gujarat as a laboratory. He's going to take the Gujarat model and spread it throughout India. And unfortunately, we are seeing this. At that time, you know, some people would say, oh, they're just sensationalists, but this is what is happening.
Actually, I'd like to give stress to your point on Hindophobia being a clever strategy by the powers that be. So monitoring Modi's rise to power and him taking office since 2014, there have been right-wing extremists in India who have been linked to a steep rise in violence and discrimination, including the, of course, what you've mentioned, the beatings of Muslims and with these draconian laws, new citizenship laws restricting the rights, as you've mentioned. And of course, we all know this is reflected in mass media, so much so that this ideology has even seeped into Bollywood, India's film industry, where Muslim actors have been frozen out and Hindu nationalists have protested against depictions of Muslims and Hindus, and even on Netflix, which is also a very huge platform. And actually, I'd also like to share the parallels here in the Philippines, since I also work as a journalist for an alternative media outfit. It's called Bulatlat. It's an online news platform. And here in the Philippines, actually, we have been facing the same struggles. Media repression is also notably widespread, and rights activists here and even truth tellers are really living in precarious times. And since under Duterte, and even way before, even during the past administrations, there have been a shutdown and silencing of even large broadcast companies such as the ABS-CBN. We also have Rappler, and it's journalists being under attack, and all the more the community journalists among our ranks. My colleagues have been slapped with trumped up charges. I personally know a lot of media colleagues. One is even my friend and also about my age. She lives in Tacloban. Her name is Frenchie May. She has been slapped with trumped up charges of terrorist financing and illegal possession of firearms, or worse, journalists here could be killed. And even under the current Marcos administration, we also have a version of that draconian law, which is called the anti-terror law. It still continues under the current administration. It grants overbroad powers to security forces to conduct surveillance and to designate groups and individuals as terrorists without due process and without clear procedures to remove such designation. So it's really very overwhelming. And like what you've said, it makes it even more difficult for ordinary people, all the more for our social movements to move and even to assert. But as we all know, the worse the crisis, the greater the resistance. Right, Cody?
That's right. And Dolores, maybe that leads to our final question. How do we take the fight away from the media and into the streets? How do we fight back against this?
I wish I had a straightforward answer. Here it is. But, you know, I think things go in waves and things go in movement. So, you know, just seeing what is happening with Palestinian solidarity. For a long time, things were quite quiet. I mean, on Nakba Day, there would be events and et cetera, but things were relatively quiet. And then with what happened, you know, 2 weeks ago, Hamas fighters going into the heartland of quote-unquote Israel kind of made everyone aware that no, resistance continues, and sometimes it's quieter and sometimes it's more spectacular, but what happened there has kind of ignited, you know, a more forceful resistance and inspired people and people who might have felt down-spirited. I mean, you know, talking to some Palestinians in exile here, you know, and more recently they were saying, yeah, like, you know, the support for Palestinian sovereignty, et cetera, is much greater outside because people in Gaza and the West Bank, they're just so caught up in day-to-day survival, you know? But now, whether it's in the West Bank, in Gaza, in the diaspora, and all of us in the solidarity movement for Palestine, there's been a kind of, you know, energy. Right. I'm coming to your question, Cody. And so in Montreal and I think elsewhere, we are seeing some of the largest demonstrations in support of freedom for Palestine. Right. And so the media, whether they like to or not, they have to pay attention. And so the people are speaking, the people are on the streets. And it can't be brushed away as a fringe movement. It can't be brushed away as, you know, groups that support terrorism. You have people from all walks of life, families, children coming out. So I think when people are mobilized, we have power. It's a question of what mobilizes, when and how. But I think the work that you are doing, that I am doing, that people in our networks are doing, is so important because we are holding things together and we are pointing out what the realities are. And we're doing this dogged work. And the fact that we're all together on this podcast actually speaks to alliances that go back decades, that I know people that you work with, that we have worked on in terms of migrant rights, anti-racism, support for democracy in our countries. This has kept us going and it helps us in the process going forward as well.
When people mobilize, they have power. I couldn't think of a better slogan to use to close up this podcast. You know, we started by talking about how the situation in India when it comes to mass media and how it's weaponized really is not very different from how it's used throughout the world by rulers who want to push their agenda. Of course, we brought a lot of emphasis on the situation that's happening in Palestine now and the media frenzy that is using to try to cover up the war crimes of the Israeli state that the people are more and more being unable to look away from. But in India, this has been happening too for decades, and how the fascist Hindutva movement has been using racial hatred, caste hatred, religious hatred to try to spin the very concrete problems of the people in terms of their landlessness, their lack of a secure livelihood, you know, more and more and more foreign intervention by corporations that are destroying the economy, and taking this anger, this righteous anger that is going at the government, and trying to turn it amongst the people to almost wipe away the problem. And of course, in our podcast series, we look at how mass media is one of those major tools they use. And so how the ruling elites and their business cronies have used this fascist ideology in the media has been a major problem for people's movements. But as you were saying, Dolores, really, this may come in waves. There may be moments of strength in our movements. There may be other times when it feels like we're pushing against the grain. But I think the message we always have with ILPS is that, you know, the people move with history. And I think that this has been a really great conversation to prove to us that in the end, the people united will never be defeated and nothing can hide the truth forever. So thank you, Dolores, so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you. Thank you, Cody. Thank you, Menj. And yes, yeah, absolutely. People united will never be defeated.
So that's a wrap for our third episode, Seek and Destroy, the Weaponization of Mass Media in India. Thank you so much, Dolores, for joining us on this another thought-provoking episode of the People's Struggle podcast on the complex relationship between militarism and mass media. And to our listeners and viewers, we hope that this podcast has provided you with valuable insights and a deeper understanding of how these forces intertwine in shaping our world.
We'll continue to have this platform to examine the intersections between imperialism, militarism, and mass media.
We hope you have enjoyed the program and stay tuned for more engaging discussions and episodes. Please email us at peoplespodcast@ilps.info if you have comments, suggestions, and any questions about the program you have just heard. You can find dates for future episodes and recordings of this and other People's Struggle podcasts on the website of the ILPS at peoplestruggle.info and on the official ILPS Facebook page. And of course, on our Spotify account, People's Struggle Podcast. Once again, I am Mensch.
And I am Cody. Thank you for your close attention, and we wish you continued success in your anti-imperialist and democratic struggles around the world. Long live international solidarity.